Just hoping they're not rushing on the writing, though. That's the problem, when you come out faster.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's something to where I feel, in a sense, they've been working on it for so many years. They probably have so many ideas and so many stories that they're like, now let's go in this direction. Let's tune it up some, but now we can kind of go in this direction with it because we kind of opened this world up more, like especially with this last one, with Evil Dead Rise. So it'll be really interesting to see what they do with it, and I hope they do crank them out, but I do agree, James, even though I do feel like they have some ideas and stuff together, I hope it's not rushed, but I hope it's faster than every, because the last one came out 2013, so let's say, hopefully quicker than every 10 years, maybe even. Even if you cut that in half, wouldn't be bad. Of course, we'd want them even sooner than that, but you cut them in half, I mean, shit.
Well, I would love to see with the contemporary Evil Dead films is maybe about 4 more films, and then actually bring the Deadites far enough in that it's actually like a plague. And the world against the Deadites. And that opens up for a whole other realm of Evil Dead.
I think that
might be what Raimi eventually wanted to do. Like everybody's like, okay, well, what's the best possible thing? Well, what if it got out? What if, Ash didn't save the day? At some point, somebody's not going to save the day. And as we saw in Evil Dead Rise, Deadites can jump from people to people, and then they can go in a nice little cabin wherever the fuck they are. And it lends well to, because Deadites fall in that weird area of supernatural and zombie.
Yeah,
we have a lot of fun with that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Now, with that idea, though, Trevor, do you think it would work better as a series? The big whatever is the movie?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I mean, I think, a movie in that direction, because of the spectacle of it, would make sense. But, continuing as a television show, at some point, it's the big thing is, are people going to keep the Evil Dead scripts fresh and not cut corners that it just becomes corny? And so far, Raimi has been really, really good about, making sure that, he picks directors. He doesn't always get his wish, but he at least gets basically, final on that. Yeah, I we trust this director. So we'll see.
Yeah. Maybe just see what they do next with that.
I mean, it seems like every horror, franchise has to have some down period of really bad stuff and then revive, but we'll see.
Yeah, but I mean, honestly, Evil Dead really didn't have anything really bad, in my opinion.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
I don't hate it. I don't care for it as much as a lot of people do. But Army of Darkness, I'm not a fan of it. It's okay.
I love Army of Darkness.
I love it too.
It was a lot more entertaining when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
To rewatch it now, the comedy influences are so obvious that you just kind of go, oh, but it's still fun.
It's fun. I'm just not crazy about that one. Like, part two is, if you want to go with the originals, part two is my favorite.
Well, part two is the one to start with.
Yes.
Evil Dead 1 is a jewel, but it is arguably more gross than the second one. Besides that, the second one has everything else going for it.
Agreed. But again, 2013 is my favorite out of the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I would go with that one, then part two, I think. Now I'm not sure after that. I'm not sure after that. Maybe part one, then Rise, and then they'll have, the other one.
Cool.
But people, that's not why we're here. We're here to discuss this movie right here, Matinee, with the man, the myth, the legend. I forgot his name.
John Goodman. Oh,
Goodman.
I forgot his name for like 2 seconds. Real play. I was like, I know his name is John. What's his last name? I know it's not Candy. It's the other one. Yes.
John, you're out of flow. You're out of flow too. You're going until you're like the legend. You're like, fuck.
Yeah. And there's no point leaving the screen up and just leaving like a blank. Oh, I'm just gonna be honest with you guys, man. It's 30. You know, sometimes I slip up. We forget. Man, this is live. Like, if it was pre-recorded, I could re-record that shit. Like, all right, here's the intro. I know the guy's name now. Nah, this is live. Boom. Forgot his name. Sorry. But, yeah, John Goodman, shout out to you. Which, he was in some shit. He was in the Flintstones, guys. The fucking Flintstones.
Yeah. Flintstones movie. Yeah. Live action.
And Roseanne. And I'm not talking about the Connors. I'm talking about Roseanne when it was...
Oh, yeah. Man,
back in the day. I love that show. I didn't watch the newer shit even without all the controversy and all that. I don't really care for certain movies that I give a different respect for, but shows that like rebooted and remade, it just feels different. It just feels way too different. And I'm just like,
that shit, you're used to them as kids and they're all adults now. You're like, nah.
Yeah. Cause I could still go back. Cause you know what it is too? Like, I could still go back to it and watch like the older shows and. The adult jokes, well, one for right now, I understand it. So I'm like, oh shit, so this is why my parents are laughing, you nasty motherfuckers. But you know what I mean? For all that shit, and then you still laugh at the childhood shit you would laugh at because you still remember those little kiddie jokes you would laugh at. And it doesn't hit the same when they remake the shows like it does for a movie. Some movies they can do good and they're cool. Some movies it's like, whatever. But I feel like shows. I feel like it's more missed than hit. I could be wrong.
I think television shows have more of a direct nostalgia with people that, you know, nowadays the adage is parents are letting their kids grow up on their iPads. When I was a kid, it was the other way. It was you're letting the television raise your kids. Well, out of necessity times you did. And I think several generations that still were focused on TV being the main device in the house, those television shows have much more nostalgia for us. They directly connect to our childhood. So when you try to reboot it, or even better, reboot it with like a 10-year span of age where the middle is missing, it just doesn't have the same, you know, it's like those people who, you know, have to go out and collect VHSs and they still have functioning square televisions or have, you know, worked out that they can run, you know, VHS is they're so obsessed with nostalgia, but that's a very small part of the populace. Television though.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And it's funny because it's like the after-school specials and stuff like that. TGIF, all those shows, like, it would feel good. It was awesome to get home from school or whatever the case may be, or 4 or 5 o'clock, you know, you do your homework, you do what you got to do, and it's like, boom, I'm watching this, I'm watching that. Saturday, I'm watching this, I'm watching that. And, yeah, when it's remade, it's just like, I'll try it out. Like, I want to watch that 90s show, but I'm scared. I'm just like...
I watched the first season. There's some funny parts, but it's more it leans towards more like Disney. It's like Full House type. It's like
it took all the fun raunchiness away, didn't it?
Yeah. Kinda.
and that's what that's what I'm saying right there. Like, if you're gonna remake the show and redo the show, keep the good shit in it. And if you guys think it's gonna be problematic,
they slip a little stuff in, like Red's in it, the you know, the father.
Yeah, I know, but still.
He still does his shit, like dumbass and all that stuff, but.
It needs to be the same. I mean, the 90s weren't soft.
Yeah.
The 90s sure. weren't 2024.
But, yeah, I watched it just to give it a shot, and I was like, okay, it's a little bit better than I thought, but it's not, like, great.
God, the Monster Squad is one of the most problematic films ever made. But so everybody loves it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's. But it's a beautiful example of where culture was circa 1990s and late 1980s.
Compared to where it is now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of nostalgia, the movie that you guys watched and invited me on here has a lot to do with nostalgia.
Yes. I want to say this. I want to talk about the movie experience. And this movie is actually a perfect example of it. I wish that for, maybe not for every single movie, but for specific movies, let's just use the horror genre. Well, shit, you can use any genre, I guess, but you got, like, what you got from this movie, as far as what it set out to be with, you know, with the action going on and the stuff going on, the guy dressed up as the ant and the thing, and the little fun stuff going on during the film. I think that would be such a fun experience. But, again, you have it to where you say, so you're in a theater, you know, theater 14 is what does that. So you want to, like, the experience, you go to theater 14. Theater 10 does not do that. So it'll be over here, it'll be right, it'll be normal, it'll be quiet. But I think that would be a fun experience to where it's like, even if you're going to pay an extra $2, so what? It'd be fun to do. I would do it. I'd watch a movie regular first. I'm like, all right, I got to see this with the experience because this is going to be fun as fuck.
Well, you know, the thing that's really hilarious is, now, of course, Woseley, who is the filmmaker, played by John Goodman, it's way over the top, and it's more than, you know, any Schlockmeister showman ever did. But this kind of stuff was very common in the 1950s and toward the beginning of the 1960s. There's this wonderful film. It's called The Tingler by William Castle.
That's all summer.
Well, it came out roughly around 1959. William Castle is actually the man who Woseley is most modeled after, because his thing was, how do you make the movie experience even better? And with him, take example, The Tingler. The Tingler, which was a Vincent Price vehicle, was about this weird thing that would attach itself to your spine and it could eventually kill you. And the schlock level that Castle did was, okay, seats in theaters randomly were actually wired for individual scenes that when the Tingler attached, the seats would shock.
That's cool.
So this is like, you know, what was really going on with a lot of the, what we like to consider B horror movies nowadays, or B monster movies. William Castle, one of the big ones was, you know, you'd be given a certificate by Lloyd's of London that if you die while you're watching this film, we will give so much money to your family. Kathy Moriarty's character, who is the woman connected to Mr. Woseley, is a nurse outside the theater in what was done by many, many filmmakers, especially by Castle, and that is having a nurse on standby or doctor on standby. These various kind of scopes and things like that. William Castle was doing it for years, and he was the best at it. But Woseley, on top of William Castle, also is very much, and we'll talk later about it, is very much like a Roger Corman. And he's also very much like Samuel Arkoff, who was a director and a producer, but owner of American International Pictures. And he was a distributor. So the gentleman that Woseley wants to, you know, impress, Mr. Spector, is basically like Samuel Z. Arkoff at the time. And so this is all like movies like this happened.
Okay.
They weren't as, you know, like crazy, but yeah, they were doing those kind of schlocky stunts.
That'd be a cool experience, though.
That's what I'm saying, though. Like, if I ever get a theater, that's one thing that will be happening. There'll be maybe two or three screens. That's it. But one screen only. It's going to be like that. The other two are going to be normal. Mm-hmm. Actually, here's how it'd be. I don't even care if I'm throwing this idea out there. One screen would be like that. One screen would be just black and white with whatever movie I can get on there. And one screen would be the normal in color. Boom. That's three different experiences. Fun.
Is there some theaters have the rumble seating?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Rumble seating. That's like the farthest they go these days. It's like rumble seating. They won't like shock you or anything. They're like, hey, we'll just.
You don't want to have something that may harm somebody. But I would say with the rumble seating, you could do more. Maybe have it more like of a vibration shake, kind of move around, not too much. Of course, you have the warning and all that shit.
Mm.
But yeah. Because you really want, I feel like there's times where you really want that, it's like a horror movie, you really want that experience. You want something to just jump up and try not to swing, though. That's the thing. If you swing, if you hit, you get kicked out.
Yo, I'm waiting for the first time.
I'm waiting for someone
to make a movie theater where you go in, you get into your seat, like a rumble seat type thing. It's a whole, like, it's like a gaming chair, and you got the VRs on, and it's like you're in the damn movie. And it's everything's moving, and you're moving around with it.
They've tried doing stuff like that in Japan, I think.
Of course they did. Japan always thinks of this shit like 10 years before everybody else.
Well, they were going to afford it. So, you know.
Of course.
Yeah.
But like I said off before we went live, when I was watching this, I was really confused. I was like, are they calling this a horror movie because the guy in it made a horror movie? Or is it because this is happening through the missile crisis, the Cuban Missile Crisis? But it was just like a side story. It wasn't even a major story. The creating of this movie and this experience with John Goodman was the main story. So I'm like, where's the horror part? But the movie was still good. I liked it. It was like to me, it was like a family movie. Mm-hmm. Like you could sit down with your family and watch it. Like it's like it's like you said, it's nostalgic. It brings you back. You're like, oh, I remember like movie theaters being somewhat like, not like 50s, but some stuff is familiar. Like you go into how movie theaters were and shit. And I'm like, oh, this is cool. Or it reminds you of other movies that you've seen, older theaters and stuff. And the creature features, that would be so cool. You go outside of the theater and they have giant ant legs connected to the theater and at the head. That'd be so cool looking. I'll be taking pictures. Like every time we gotta go to the theater. I gotta take a picture out front.
And going back to it though, James, like from this movie and from other fun horror movies that we've watched where they take place in a theater where they're doing all these fun little themes like this, that is what would drive people to go to the theaters more. Because you're getting that fun experience. That's where you're getting those people that like to be loud in theaters. It's like, now I can be loud with these people. You know what I mean? Because it's not frowned upon here because once there's a jump scare, there's going to be a real jump scare. Once there's a big laugh, there's going to be a big laugh. Once there's going to be this. And I feel, why the fuck not? Why isn't that out
there? Well, just say, jump in real quick because I don't want to forget. James, you are not alone with wondering why this is a horror movie. So when it came out in 1993, it bombed massively, partially because audiences weren't ready for a film like that, even though the following year Ed Wood came out and it became a huge thing. It was just a little too early for this kind of weird nostalgic meta film. So Dante, best known for Piranha, The Howling, Inner Space, but especially the Gremlins short-lived franchise, was not really a horror director per se, but
okay, true.
They didn't know even though it is literally basically like let's take Stand By Me, but also mix it in with this amazing love letter to cinema at that time period. I mean, so yeah, it's not a horror movie. The only horror that's really in the film is the paranoia that comes from, you know, the they're living in Florida in the Keys, so they're only 90 miles away from Cuba in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's actually less paranoia in the film than you would expect, because
that's what threw me off.
A beautiful job of portraying teenagers, and that their life is their life. They're just out.
We're invincible.
You've got the one there that's, you know, really outspoken, but everyone else is like, I want to date her. Oh yeah, there might be a new girl. She's cute. It did a beautiful job of showing that, you know, insular way that teenagers can look at society. But you got to remember that this was the closest we had ever come to nuclear war, after years and years of Red Scare, and then after we dropped the bomb, we basically said, okay, other people can drop the bomb. And there was a lot of fear. There's a reason why in the 1950s you have all these big insect movies, like Mantis and Them, which is about ants. So there, boom, you have that, which is a paranoia. But at the same time, you also have McCarthyism and the Blacklist. And it's even said in the film at one point about how, you know, he was able to get so-and-so to do whatever. Oh, that person's been blacklisted. Which meant at the time, if you were brought up in front of McCarthy and his team of wonderful idiots, and somebody said you were a commie, you were a commie until you gave up other people. So this is a time when it was really hard to be an artist in the United States. You know, one of the biggest, like, okay, I'll throw my friends in front of the bus actors was Ronald Reagan. So there you have that, which is a constant fear, because, you know, all somebody would have to say is your material is leftist and leaning. So you have that going on. And, you know, that's where the horror kind of lies. You also have, there's a reference to how the PTA, you know, wants to ban the film. Yet again, everybody was, you know, very easily, when you mix in the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then you have these two guys that are, you know, standing in front of the theater and yelling about, you know, how this is horrible, it's work of the devil, which those particular actors are very, very important in the film. But it just, that's the paranoia. That's as close to horror as it gets. It is, you know, I don't know, like Stand By Me meets Ed Wood. In its own way.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But no, one of the things that made it bomb and pretty much kill Joe Dante, they get mixed up pretty much, Joe Dante's career, was that they didn't know what to market it to, but it got some of the best ratings that year of any film.
Really?
I mean, it was, it was amazingly critically acclaimed, but they didn't know what they had. The meta film didn't really exist, and it was, I think, pre The Player. So,
Dr. Sleep. That's cool. I've never seen this one yet.
Was it Dr. Sleep?
I see that one.
Yep. I haven't watched it yet. I read the book. Well, I did the audio book.
I've put it off because I am such a huge fan of Kubrick's Shining. So.
Well,
if
you're free next Thursday,
I like The Shining also. And I audiobooked Dr. Sleep.
Same.
The book is always better.
Oh, of course.
But the movie, I didn't think it was...
King is very wordy, but with him being very wordy comes a lot more content in those books.
Exactly. So, so Dr. Sleep was the movie. It wasn't bad. I can say that. It wasn't bad. It explained a lot of things, like from the book and everything, like from the first movie. I didn't know what The Shining was. I thought they were just in a haunted hotel and the father got possessed. I didn't know it was, it was about the dude because the kid had a special power and shit.
All this other shit. Yeah.
So, you know, I was like, what the fuck? But anyways, we'll talk about that next week.
That's going to be good. Like I said, I've never seen the movie, so I'm excited for that.
Well, I mean, looking at Matinee is, say if we remove the moniker of horror, did you guys enjoy the movie?
Oh, I enjoyed it. Yeah, I said that to Aaron. I messaged him. I was like, hey, because I thought I was watching the wrong movie. Mm-hmm. Because I looked up Matinee. There's a movie called The Matinee. It's a slasher film. It came out 2020. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I was watching this. I was like, this is not a horror movie. So I was like, yo, Aaron, you sure this? I was like, am I watching the right movie? And he sent me the picture. I was like, oh, okay. Because I was like, this is not horror. I was like, because I told him the other one. I was like, it came out 2020. It's a slasher. He's like, no, that's the right one. Because it's the CFF movie. I was like, okay, so I watched it, but I was like, then I wrote to him, I was like, it's a good movie. I was just expecting horror, but no, it was like good acting. I like the story. It's like kid has moved to town, like no friends, makes friends and shit. It's like a little mini story through a thing. He makes friends with the guy who's making the film and doing the fucking, yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, what was it like? You said about little things, and I want to point something out. It's very important in the beginning of the film. excuse me. When Gene is sitting at the recess playground, he's got a Famous Monsters of Filmland in his hand. Mm-hmm. So this was a magazine that started printing in 1958. 4E.J. Ackerman was the editor, and this magazine at that time literally took the place of every horror fan today connecting via any chat room, any group or whatever. One magazine was your Bible if you were that kid that loved monsters. It was also where you heard about old monster movies. And then it got you wanting to actually try to find these films. Because at the time, if it's not in a theater, you're shit out of luck. So that's very, very important. That's a little thing. But Gene is a monster kid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was that generation of monster kids that Joe Dante was. There's... especially in this film, a very autobiographical quality. So at that time, Dante would have been about that old, 1962. And that kid reading Famous Monsters of Filmland, having to get to the next crazy movie, the one that sits there and somebody asks him some simple question about a monster movie, and he starts going off. Joe Dante was one of those many kids. Your whole, like, you know, bulk of 80s directors, that was their kid. So that was them when they were kids. And that's what kept them together. They communicate through Famous Monsters of Filmland. And, you know, another thing is, in the theater, on the marquee and every one of those posters are films that came out in the year of 1962.
Oh, nice.
Yes. Yeah. So it's... when you look at the movie that way, it even spreads the horror thing thinner because it really has this wonderful autobiographical quality when you just look at Joe Dante.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now you said you see this in theaters, Trevor?
Yeah, I did see it in theaters, and it was great. You know, it's very sad. In a couple ways. Now, Dante has remained very active, and he is starting to do work again. But I don't know how official this is, but it did come up on a reputable news site. Actually, Mick and I were joking today about, you know, what if Joe Dante would get together with Roger Corman before he died, because Roger Corman discovered Joe Dante, and he and who's ever left of the Roger Corman training camp, like Martin Scorsese, would do a film. Joe Dante has officially been attached to a remake of Little Shop of Horrors. Now, I hope this actually happens. And it happens before Corman passes away. And Corman's like, God, he's like 90-something, like 95 or something. But he's nonstop. So, you know, it's funny. We talked about that today, and it looks like that might happen.
That'd be crazy.
And take it back to the original Little Shop of Horrors, which is a straight-up horror film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I remember that.
It was great, but that was our image of it in that time period.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. I haven't seen
it. The first one had Jack Nicholson, you know, having his little Audrey, you know, to eat people, you know, and legitimately eat them. You
know. Oh, man. I got to watch that again. It's been years.
Mm-hmm. Child. Feed me, Seymour.
There you go. Little Shop of Horrors. Yeah. I wanted to dive into ratings before we forget.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see. James, what'd you rate this one?
I enjoyed it better now that a lot of it was explained. I'm going to give this one a 7.
Cool. That's fair. How about you, Trevor?
Ooh. 8.5.
Ooh.
Because I do enjoy the movie more each time I watch it. Because there's a lot of little stuff going on.
Yeah, there is. Mm-hmm. I did enjoy the movie. I had a good time. A little less of a good time than you, James. I gave it a 6.5. Mm-hmm. Not a bad movie at all. I think if it was more, like, I know I, again, explained, I did enjoy it more. And with the horror elements, I did enjoy it. But if it had, I think if it had more of a turn towards horror, I would have enjoyed it a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Or the element towards horror, but I love the concept, and I love the theater was like my favorite part of this damn movie. I'm just like, that in real life would be so damn fun. Of course, what they were going for was such a cool, fun idea.
Especially the mindset, like, yo, we're going to put this little miniature earthquake machine up in this place and have this whole building shake.
Which was just crazy.
Where if you turn it up too high, it's going to crumble the building. The whole top floor caves in.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell? Right.
We don't need the earthquake machine, but just everything else that happened. Like, for example, the part where the lady's looking back and she's like behind you, she screams, and the dude with the ant suit pops up and he starts running around and shit. Like, stuff like that would be cool.
Yeah.
Of course, if it fits the theme, but this, oh my gosh.
Yeah, put that one dude in a panic. That fucking guy, he was the most paranoid fucking person in the world. The owner of the theater.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, with the radio in his pocket and shit. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Well, another thing, you know, as far as, you know, really appreciating, you know, that this movie is actually telling, you know, pretty much a real story. You know, of course, some of it is, you know, over the top, but between 1959 and 1962, these are some of the movies that actually were released. Manster, The Killer Shrews, The Wasp Woman, The Giant Leeches, and The Alligator People. And the list goes on.
I want to watch them.
By 1962, you started seeing things like The Pit and the Pendulum and Premature Burial and that whole gothic thing kind of take over. But no, so Woseley is like William Castle toward the end of his career, where he's just trying every conceivable new concept to just keep his livelihood going, which then eventually William Castle went on to just direct films and things of that nature. But William Castle had a big old cigar. Samuel J. Arkoff also had a big old cigar. And, you know, the opening of the film in which, you know, Woseley is seated there talking about, I have a new film. It's called Mant. It is almost line for line taken by the introductions for most of William Castle's films, Tingler, Homicidal, Dr. Sardonicus, 13 Ghost, which was eventually remade, and I think remade again. But no, that he's the main guy that Woseley's supposed to be, as far as a character in real life.
Okay. Nice. Is this something you guys would watch again? This movie here?
I mean, if it was on, I'll watch it, yeah. I mean, yeah, it was good. But like you said, I say every time, and you know me, I go for new stuff. I hardly go back and rewatch stuff.
See, I'm more towards the middle with that now, James. Like, there's certain shit that I'm always going to go back and watch. I'm never going to not do that. I'm never going to apologize for doing that. But then there's ones where I'm just like, you know what? I really don't need to see this again. Yeah, I'm good. I've seen it enough. Or, you know, I'm good on it. But then there's just those ones where it's just like, nah.
There's just so many movies out there I haven't seen.
It's like, I know.
Why wouldn't I choose something new? You know, like, I'm not gonna, why would I watch Friday the 13th again? After the 1,000th time. But don't get me wrong. When I was younger, I watched the shit. I watched it a million times. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it is. I think I just watched repeats of so many movies when I was younger.
You know what it is? You know what it is?
No, but I missed out on a lot of movies.
Just to shoot Friday the 13th some bail is, at the very least, if you're a fan of it, and you're like, you know what? I'm only going to watch it on Friday the 13th. I'm going to watch as many as I can every Friday the 13th, or at least that weekend. I accept that. That's fair. That's
Jason
fair.
Voorhees. You're like, Jason Voorhees is my main man. Main horror icon. Always has been.
So, would it be a controversial statement for me to say that my favorite is Jason Goes to Hell?
Wait, what?
That is my favorite of the Jason films, Jason Goes to Hell.
A lot of people hate that one.
I adore it. It's the most creative of the entire franchise.
Everybody hated that. A lot of people hated that one. I didn't mind it, but the hate that movie got.
It's definitely my least favorite. I'm not going to lie to you. But I do get it. I do get it. Like, I've heard other
people's... You're right. It was creative, the storyline. But that's the thing. People are listening to the story like, wait, what the hell are you doing to Jason? For one, how did a full body just rip out of a body with clothes and everything?
Yeah. It didn't feel like a Jason movie, I guess you would say. It didn't feel like a Friday the 13th or a Jason movie.
It was weird.
It took a very interesting way of trying to... I mean, it was pretty much assumed at a certain point that Jason Takes Manhattan, that there's something supernatural. We just know this by now. But there was a need to explain it even further, because they knew that, you know, because I think it was New Line that owned the rights to both the Freddy films and the Jason films. They knew there was going to be a team at some point. And I think that was the idea, but yet again, I think the script and everything just got out of hand. I love the movie because it is so weird. It offers me everything other Jason films don't.
It makes sense. The
worst is Jason Takes Manhattan, because that was the biggest opportunity.
I agree.
75 minutes of him just tearing people apart in Manhattan, and Manhattan's reaction to him would have been amazing.
Yep,
I agree.
Get rid of the boat and the teenagers and deliver that movie that we all saw the poster and went, yeah.
100%. 100%.
Agreed, a million percent.
I was so disappointed in that one. That is the worst one to me.
Then at the end of the movie, have him arm wrestle Mick Manhattan just to do it for us.
That's the only way he become king of Manhattan.
Yep, that's how he takes Manhattan, because he beats him in arm wrestling.
Mick is the final boss.
Or cuts his hand off with a machete because he gets pissed off. Either way, that's what we'll take.
You mentioned it before about rewatchability. I would say this is either my fifth or sixth time.
For this movie?
For this film, yeah.
Okay.
It's one of my, I'd have to say it's one of my favorite Joe Dante films all around.
But like you said, this one is a nostalgia. It's like, you can watch it over and over again. There's the little things in it you find.
I'd much rather watch this over and over again than watch Piranha or
100%
over and over again.
Okay.
Which,
I
you know,
could see like that. I could see that, because with Piranha, I love it. It was fun and all that stuff. But it's like, how you can only watch that so many times. I'm not saying you can't watch it again and again, but it's like, okay, I watched it today. I'm not going to watch it again for a few years. With this movie here, I can see myself watching it once a year for whatever reason. If you know what I mean? Like, I could see at least once a year, once every whatever. But yeah, this definitely has more of a rewatchability. I could see that. I could definitely.
It's also, you know, I hate to say it, but it's a really cute movie. I mean, at the time, there was a lot going on. So, you know, it was, you know, maybe around 7-8 years before the Stand By Me came out. So, you know, like these, you know, children coming of age films. But this was the children coming of age films for us monster kids. You know, us kids that, you know, just kept to ourselves and we talked about our movies and all that kind of stuff. And then we'd, you know, all flock to the theater. You know, of course, it's being a different time period. But it was the movie where that ended up being the cool things. You know, us geeks that are into movies got the girls. We're the heroes. I love that about the film. Because, of course, Starkweather, who is a nice little jab to Charlie Starkweather, who was a spree killer at the time, to be the villain. You know, the nerds took out the bully, even though he's another idiot.
Yeah.
John Goodman's character is like, he's like a total con artist too in this thing. Because his machine broke, they're like, you destroyed my building. He's like, no, the kid, he did it. He pointed at the kid who's getting arrested already. He was like, he did it. What are you talking about? Yeah, he
messed up everything, which, I mean, he did mess up a lot
of
shit.
Actually, he did, yeah.
He caused all that, because had he not chased the kid and attacked him and all that other bullshit didn't happen, nothing would have happened.
I had a dumb moment, too, because I was like, I don't know why I thought, like, the 50s were, like, dinosaur years or something. But at the end, when he blamed the kid and the owner started flipping in, that really old guy was a Specter. Mr. Specter was walking in with them, and he goes, "That's what you got insurance." I was like, "They didn't have insurance in 50." I was like, "Wait a minute, yeah, they did." I was like, "What the fuck is wrong with me?" I was like, "They're not that old."
62, so yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I was like, "They're not that old. There was insurance back then. What the fuck is wrong with me?"
It's just one of those things. You kind of see the style of it and you think it's older than what it really is, because we, in the back of our minds, I feel like we still have that little kid brain where it's like, 1950 is so old.
Yeah, like, damn, you're so old.
Or it's like, you're saying a certain age is so old, but then you're like, fuck, man, I'm like right around the corner from a certain age. It's not that old.
Yeah,
we used to talk a lot of shit with our kids.
I caught myself. I felt so dumb when I finished the sentence in my head. Like, I was talking to myself in my head. I was like, what the fuck is wrong with me?
Oh, that's fucking funny. That's fucking funny.
The other thing that, you know, I think people didn't really get when it first came out, and, you know, nowadays with directors like Wes Anderson. And just, you know, how, you know, even look at Fallout, how Fallout is. It has a very, you know, kind of almost plastic quality to it. This film, you know, presents 1962 in total prestige. Like, there's, you know, not dirt on the road. There's, you know, It is supposed to kind of look a little off and a little fantasy-esque. And I think that time it kind of confused some people too. And yet again, goes back to it, James. A lot of people, you know, went in with the idea like, oh, it's Joe Dante. Oh, it's a horror movie. But you'd think when you put John Goodman on your movie poster, people would go, well, this is a comedy. But
there's a little comedy in it. They had it. They made him poke at his fallout shelter. He's like, where'd you get this? He's like, oh, I bought it out of the magazine or something. So that's why it's easily they took it apart. Like it was nothing. Yeah, like,
yep.
Like, you dumbass. You ordered this shit. It's like today, don't order the shit over online. Like, where'd you order this? Amazon? You dumbass.
Now, at that time, it probably would have still been Sears and Roebuck. Yeah. The Amazon since the 1920s.
Yep. This here, though, I mean, again, you kind of horror-ish. I think it'd be a good introduction for kids for horror, for ones that aren't into it at all, just because the little elements it does have in there, it's not over the top at all. It's real silly. It's like a fun, funny way. And it's not a lot. It's not like in your face all the time a lot. So it'd be kind of a little more than subtle, I guess you would say.
It showed a lot of scenes of the Mant movie.
Mm-hmm.
There was like zoom up of the... I thought that the Ant-Man dude looked pretty cool.
I did too.
Oh, that was very well made. Yeah. I love the explanation of somehow an ant's saliva gets into his bloodstream.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was just...
It happened at exact the same time this happened.
Excuse me?
You're like, what? What? How the doctor was explaining it. It was like, something happened at this exact time when this happened. He got bit. That's how he mutated. Like, okay. Try to make scientists, you try to make it turn into like
some scientific,
like Incredible Hulk shit. Like, gamma rays type thing.
Turn to a damn ant.
But no, you got to do that in those movies. No? Like, how did this happen? An ant just bit him. There's something wrong with the ant. Yeah, it's a radioactive fucking ant, like Spider-Man, you know?
That time, the movies basically had to do with something, you know, it was in the 1950s when you had the monster and creature features. It was usually either atomic, it was something that was somewhat damning to science because science did this. Or it was a Red Scare film based on the xenophobia of people from outer space.
Yep.
Yeah, those three
outer space monsters. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those were massive and those were big. And a lot of them were made about as well as the Mant movie.
Yeah.
I have a very large part of my heart for, you know, I remember on network television, especially on Sundays, where I first got my taste of Godzilla, was also where I first got my taste of The Fly.
Yeah, The Fly.
Them.
Yep.
All these movies, that I don't know if they have a great rewatchability as I get older, but yeah. I still feel very, you know, nostalgic about them.
Mm-hmm.
I think kids are, we used to be like, you know, you spoon fed us initially with Godzilla and big monsters from the 50s and 60s or alien invasions. And now I think people just kind of jump in with like, well, this is a horror film. So.
Yeah. Yeah. But this was definitely a fun watch. Wow. Get your words out there. Mm-hmm. Definitely a fun watch. And again, it's at the very least worth a one-time watch. I think it's worth more than one. I just don't know when I would get to it again, because like you were saying, James, for the most part, I do try to watch newer to me, because it could be a newer movie to me that came out in 1987 that I've never
that's what I mean. Yeah, something I've never seen before. That's what I mean.
So newer to me. Let me rephrase that when I say that. Newer to Sturdy. If I've never seen it, it's newer to me. I don't care when it came out. But
kind of the way I view it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you not see that? It didn't come across my radar.
I find more joy now going deeper down roads of different countries and different genres and finding something that really generally, you know, appeals to me and, you know, makes my, you know, my ears prick up, and versus what's coming out now in horror and science fiction. There's good stuff. It's just like everything else, you know, of course the major studios, diarrhea most of the time. But, you know, even now it's harder to find the indie stuff because there's so much stuff like, you know, pressed in our faces and how many different streaming programs. So
yeah, it's true.
So true. Freaking many. So yeah. Freaking many. You're right about that. You're right. Oh my God.
How many shark movies do you have to get to before you get to something else?
Or a good one.
Yeah. They're doing one with a three-headed shark that's coming out sometime this year. It looks adequately pathetic.
Nice. Some of those are fun as hell. Don't get me wrong. Within there, some are just like, this isn't fun. It's just bad.
I think, yeah, you had a three-headed one. I think it was like three-headed shark attack or something. It was
Oh, there's plenty. Yeah. There's plenty.
So dumb.
Oh, man. I can't wait to watch another shitty shark movie. That'll be coming up at some point. People, don't worry.
I'd rather watch those than Sharknado, though. For some reason, I have a hate for Sharknado.
Same here.
I don't know why.
I just cannot. Is it Tara Reid?
No, because I did. I like the movie we just reviewed with Tara Reid in it.
What movie was that?
The fucking
Charlie's movie. Farm.
Charlie's Farm. I thought that fucking movie was awesome.
That's right.
I thought it was Tara. I just think it's stupid. A tornado that has a whole bunch of sharks in it. It's so stupid. I don't know.
But one of the many. You know, at the time, if it was made by Sci-Fi, the television station, it was made for no money at all, and their productions look that way. And that was my biggest thing about Sharknado. It looked painfully cheap. And,
yeah, painfully cheap, and somehow the CGI is like overdone.
Mm-hmm.
Like it wasn't good. It's just like they just cranked up the dial. They're like, "Yo, we're gonna make this shark look like." Ridiculously CGI, where everybody could tell, a fucking newborn baby can tell this is CGI.
Oh, this is bad. Start crying when the baby sees it. Start crying because that shit's dying.
Just the Sharknado, like the tornado with the sharks, made no sense. Clownado made more sense than the Sharknado. You ever watched Clownado?
I'm not sure. I think so. It wasn't. No,
it's
you know,
like, it's like a tornado of supernatural clowns. It's like a supernatural tornado of clowns.
Yep.
Oh, you're talking about Insane Clown Posse show.
Yeah, that's who, maybe.
So it's a movie about really fucked up juggalos. Wait, that's
Yeah, Clownado. I was like, what the fuck is this? I watched that before. And I was like, all right. But Sharknado, for some reason, I hate it. I don't know.
I'm with you.
And there's there's like nine of them now, Sharknado in space. There can't be a tornado in space. What the fuck are you talking about?
That's the only one I want to see is if there's one that goes to space. Because I had, you know what, I'm not going to say it on the live. Matter of fact, we're going to wrap this one up. Listen, people.
Yeah.
You got to go check out our amazing guest, Trevor, and Ambassador Radio.
For having me.
Of course, of course. This guy knows his shit. Not just movies, but music and a bunch of other knowledge. Shows. Everything. He calls it useless knowledge. I call it very important knowledge. Because someone's going to want to know about it. And then, of course, you can check myself and James out, co-hosts over on Popcorn and Pints every Saturday at 9 o'clock. We are back this weekend doing Highlander and Short Circuit. Someone on here really loves one of those movies and really hates the other. You'll find out which and who. I'm not going to give you any spoilers. And of course, be on the lookout for Horror Research 30 every Thursday at 8 o'clock Eastern Time. And under the same umbrella, Bastardo Vision every Friday at midnight. Technically Saturday at 12 a.m. This weekend, we are doing Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Part 3.
That's a good one.
And Shocker. So a doubleheader.
Yeah.
GCM 3. Angel
3 is not given as much love as it should have been.
And Shocker. I only watched it one time very recently, so it'll be a fun rewatch because I don't really remember it. Mm-hmm. But tune in for that, people. We'll be watching that live tomorrow. are reviewing that live tomorrow, not watching that. I'll see you in your nightmares. Peace.
Peace.
Thank you guys very much.